Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Lowy Institute. I'm Michael Fullilove, the Executive Director. Apologies for starting a little late today, but I'm delighted to welcome you to this event in which the Minister for Defence Industry, the Honourable Christopher Pyne MP, will give his first speech to the Institute. Ladies and gentlemen, as we enter what looks like being a difficult period in international affairs, Australia needs a highly capable military, one that is able to protect the full breadth of our interests. A strong ADF will better enable us to protect our territory and our citizens. It will lend us weight in the eyes of potential adversaries and earn us influence in the minds of friends and allies. Given the uncertainty about future developments in Asia and the widespread concern about the trajectories of both the United States and China, this is an urgent priority for our country. In last year's Defence White Paper, the Turnbull government projected that by 2020-21, Australia would be spending 2% of its GDP on defence. In the future, I think a credible ADF may well cost us more than that. It certainly won't cost less. For Australia, I'm afraid, the era of cheap security is over. We're very pleased, therefore, to be hosting the Minister with responsibility for overseeing this build-up of the ADF. Ladies and gentlemen, Christopher Pyne was educated at the University of Adelaide. A trained lawyer, he was elected to the House of Reps for the seat of Sturt at the age of 25. In the Howard government, he served as Minister for Ageing. In the Abbott government, he served as Leader of the House and Minister for Education and Training. In the first Turnbull ministry, he was Minister for Industry, Innovation and Science. Following the 2016 federal election, he was appointed Minister for Defence Industry, and in this capacity, he's announced a number of major investments, including a $90 billion continuous shipbuilding program. Mr. Pyne will make some remarks, and then my colleague, Dr. Ewan Graham, Director of our International Security Program, will chair the Q&A. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the podium the Minister, Christopher Pyne.
Thank you very much, Michael. It's a great pleasure to be here at the Lowy Institute. A very distinguished institute with a distinguished board and an excellent director and executive director in Michael Fullilove. The Lowy Institute does a great job in stimulating debate and discussion on policy and Australia's place in the world. The contribution is particularly valuable on foreign and defence policy. It does lead me to think of the 19th century philosopher and student of Napoleon, Karl von Clausewitz, who had much to say in his enduring analysis on war, about the relationship between war and politics. His elegant prose is these days distilled down to simply, war is the extension of politics by other means. I'm no stranger to this phenomenon, as you can imagine. Some of the opposition's more outlandish shock and awe tactics often cause me to wonder what part is politics and which is simply war. However, it is Clausewitz's view on strategy that I like the most. He said the talent of a strategist is to identify the decisive point and to concentrate everything on it, removing forces from secondary fronts and ignoring lesser objectives. In other words, concentrate on the main game is how Napoleon, of course, won many of his greater victories. 300 years on, we can look to that view of strategy to articulate the Turnbull government's approach to defence industry. This government has set its own decisive point as the establishment of a sovereign defence industry fit to last a century. It involves the transformation of our strategic industrial base. We are well on the way to doing this. Through the 2016 Defence White Paper, the Defence Industry Policy Statement, and the Integrated Investment Plan, the Turnbull government has laid out a clear vision for expansion of Australia's defence industry. Today, as we look to the end of a busy year, which can't come soon enough, I have to say, I want to update you on where we are up to in implementing all of this. It was only a year and a half ago since I was sworn in as Australia's first Minister for Defence Industry. Recognising the importance of defence industry to our defence forces, I'm focused on ensuring that we are maximising our Australian industry content in developing the capability of the Australian Defence Forces. In February of this year, the Turnbull government announced a $200 billion commitment to the largest peacetime renewal of our defence capability since World War II. It's an enormous undertaking, unprecedented in its scope. It provides simultaneously for the defence and security of our nation and contributes mightily to the future prosperity of our Australian community. This massive program supports and readies us to defend and secure our borders. It helps us assure peace and security in our region. It enables us to contribute to security around the globe, wherever our presence is welcomed and needed. It supports the men and women of our Defence Force who serve to protect us, the people who put themselves in harm's way. By creating a major sovereign defence industry for the long term, it enhances our self-reliance in a global context. Through an unprecedented construction program, by far our largest and most diverse ever, it creates jobs and boundless opportunities in which Australian industry and business can innovate and thrive. For those aspiring to work in defence industry, it provides new direction and new training opportunities. For young Australians in our schools, our universities, colleges and TAFEs, it points the way to the jobs of the future. You may have seen the advertisements on television and elsewhere that describe the workforce behind the Defence Force. That workforce is the under-recognised but deeply effective human enabler of our defence capability. We want the Australian community, workers, businesses and job seekers, to be alert to the tremendous long-term opportunities in defence industry. The campaign emphasises science, technology, engineering and maths. It's essential that enough young Australians are in this pipeline of skills and expertise that will be so much in demand in the future. People with trade, technical and management skills to support continuous shipbuilding will be in high demand. Australians looking for work, perhaps those in automotive areas, might find new opportunities in defence industry. Increased demand for industry capability will extend across many industry sectors, from construction to ICT and cyber to medical, project management and services. Shaping those sectors to prioritise defence and be defence ready will take time. A robust defence industry helps put the nation in a better economic position than it might otherwise be. It will become an extremely important aspect of our economy well into the future. This is fundamental to our global and regional security and our defence readiness. Under Labor, there was an unforgivable six-year drought of ship orders long beset by indecision. Not one ship was commissioned over 6 years from an Australian shipyard. We've replaced that with our naval shipbuilding plan, released earlier this year, which injects around $90 billion in a strong and sustainable naval shipbuilding industry. The plan will overhaul Australia's naval capability, create economic growth, stimulate Australian industry involvement and secure thousands of jobs for decades to come. By employing Australian workers in Australian shipyards with Australian resources, it will reach deep into the community and the economy and spread those benefits. It will see continuous construction from now until the middle of the century of 12 submarines, 9 frigates, and 33 smaller vessels. Work on the Naval Shipbuilding Plan is well underway. Our Australian team working on the Future Submarines Program have already started relocating from Australia to Hughes House, our purpose-built joint facility in Cherbourg. They are working on the concept and preliminary design of the Future Submarine. A pre-sizing activity was completed in September 2017. With solid agreement on the initial sizing envelope of the future submarine. I was glad to participate in a keel-laying ceremony for the first of 21 Pacific Patrol boats at Henderson in Western Australia in July this year. Last month, I announced Lurssen's selection as the prime contractor for our 12 offshore patrol vessels. This multi-billion dollar project will be delivered by Australian workers in Australian shipyards using Australian steel. More than $1 billion is already being invested in modern shipyard infrastructure at Osborne and Henderson, and $25 million is allocated to workforce growth and skilling initiatives starting in January next year. We recently announced the selection of Lendlease as the managing contractor for the upgrade of the Osborne South Shipyard in Adelaide. That project alone is worth over $500 million and will create over 600 jobs at its peak. We'll also deliver significant upgrades to our Collins-class submarines and our Anzac-class frigates. A workforce that is appropriately skilled and allows Australian defence industry to do the job is essential to fulfil our vision to ensure a continuous naval shipbuild. The naval shipbuilding workforce is expected to grow to around 5,200 workers by the mid to late 2020s, with more than quadruple this number in sustainment activities and supply chains across Australia. Many will need to be trained or retrained, which is why, in collaboration with my former departments of education and industry, we're developing a strategic workforce plan for the naval shipbuilding enterprise as a whole. The plan will guide the operations of our new naval shipbuilding college. The college will attract, train and retrain the workers that we need for our continuous shipbuilding program, and will start in early 2018. We must also ensure that the workforce which has been working on the air warfare destroyer project is retained. The previous government created a valley of death by not commissioning any ships, but this government is committed to fixing that problem and providing long-term security to the workers at Osborne. That's why just this week I announced that the Turnbull government will be investing around $30 million to retain 200 workers at Osborne. This will include 50 workers going to the Future Submarine Project Office, 50 people going to Collins Sustainment and Maintenance Operations, and up to 100 scholarships for workers to upskill their computer-aided design and manufacturing skills, and that's in addition to the 600 working on construction at Osborne South Shipyard and the 400 that will be needed for the offshore patrol vessels. Put together, these initiatives will ensure that Australia's future shipbuilding industry will have the right skills at the right time available to ensure that it'll be as successful as possible. We've also seen progress on the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter program to give the Royal Australian Air Force unprecedented capability in the air. Because we signed up to the project early, Australian defence industry is now reaping the benefits. Companies like Morand in Victoria are one of the biggest beneficiaries in Australia. Morand was formerly in the automotive sector. Morand now make tailpieces and specialised engine trailers for the Joint Strike Fighter. They announced earlier this year that over the next decade, their order book from the project, from the Joint Strike Fighter project alone, will be worth more than $1 billion. We're pushing ahead with our $4 to $5 billion Land 400 Phase 2 project to build the new combat reconnaissance vehicles to enhance our land operations. This is a demonstrably huge undertaking, reflecting a fundamentally different approach to defence industry. It's focused on a clear, decisive point, our future security. On the way there, it provides confidence and direction for industry and unlimited potential for Australian defence to constantly renew itself to meet ever-evolving and changing challenges. To support small to medium enterprises across Australia, to promote competitiveness and guide priorities across defence industry, I opened the Centre for Defence Industry Capability over a year ago. It's an essential component of the 2016 Defence Industry Policy Statement and resets defence and industry relationship. We also launched the Defence Innovation Hub, investing around $640 million into maturing and developing cutting-edge technology for the ADF. The Hub's also already received over 330 innovation proposals. Around $23 million in innovation contracts have already been signed with Australian industry. In March this year, we launched the Next Generation Technologies Fund, a $730 million investment in the emerging technologies of the future Defence Force. In July came the Defence Cooperative Research Centre, the first one of its kind. It's a $50 million centre addressing trusted autonomous systems and is bringing together academia, research, industry and defence to deliver game-changing unmanned platforms. We're giving certainty to Australian industry, guiding them so they can reinvest reliably in skills, infrastructure and innovation themselves for their long-term capability. And there is still much more that we plan to do. By mid-2018, we'll have announced a successful tenderer for the Land 400 combat reconnaissance vehicles and the future frigates. Between them, they're $40 billion projects. A defence industry skilling and STEM strategy will be released at around the same time to match demand for defence industry capability with the workforce and skills required. We're also currently developing our first defence industrial capability plan, which will lay out our sovereign industrial capabilities, those industrial capabilities we absolutely must maintain here in Australia. We are busy, step by step, making the decisions required to fulfil an ambitious and vital agenda. The past year has also seen us expand the opportunities for Australian industry to grow its capabilities. In 2016-17, we issued 74 defence capability-related project approvals. This financial year already, we've made 61 such decisions. It's a significant increase in approvals. Before the introduction of the Integrated Investment Program, the highest number of defence capability-related approvals achieved in a year, not including IT and infrastructure approvals, was 46. In June this year, I strengthened Australian involvement in defence projects. This fortified the template for the Australian Industry Capability Plan requirements on tenders for all major capital equipment procurements of $20 million and above. Tenderers must address how Australian industry involvement will be maximised across a given project. It will require them to outline how they will build enduring industrial capability, transferring technology and intellectual property, and promote export opportunities for Australian businesses. We are a country that has to wring every bit of capability we can from every dollar in order to achieve our defence mission with a relatively small but highly advanced force. We can't change the scale, scope, and capability of our defence industry overnight. That will come from commitment, vision, timely decisions, and action. And that is exactly what the Turnbull government has started. Now it's up to defence industry to help us to reach those objectives. With the huge existing expertise in our defence force behind us, we're creating new opportunities for industry on an unprecedented scale. We are giving them the confidence to invest, take risks, and provide leadership of their own. In early November, we announced a $207 million boost to the Nolka active missile decoy system. We achieved an important first stage contract milestone with Raytheon in the short-range ground-based air defence project, the surface-to-air missile defence systems, a project worth up to $2 billion. We announced that Australia's fleet of 9 future frigates would be equipped with the Aegis Combat Management System, but we also announced that that would be coupled with an Australian tactical interface developed right here by Saab Australia. The government mandated that where the high-end warfighting capabilities of the Aegis system are not required, a Saab Australia-developed combat management system will be used on all Australia's future ship projects. Only this morning, I was pleased to be at Macquarie Park, which is why I was late, with the Prime Minister to announce a partnership between BAE and Raytheon. This has led to the creation of 50 new jobs right here in Sydney to sustain the combat system of the air warfare destroyer. These decisions will all significantly drive our investment in Australia's long-term sovereign defence industry capability. We're also asking global primes to do more through the Global Supply Chain Program, under which the primes are contracted to identify and award export contracts on merit. These efforts are bearing fruit. And during my recent visit to the United Kingdom, I also announced that 2 Australian companies had won work on that country's BAE Systems Type 26 Global Combat Ship Construction Program. Tasmanian-based Life Raft Systems Australia will provide the ship's marine evacuation system, which is a pretty fancy word for life raft, I think, while Victorian-based Mackay Consolidated Industries will supply pipe hanger inserts. Through the Global Supply Chain Program, they've been able to find export opportunities in BAE Systems supply chain. And these 2 contracts will support around 220 Australian jobs, whether BAE wins the contract for future frigates or not. On top of this, Fincantieri Australia have engaged Hoffman Engineering from Western Australia to manufacture a bow thruster for one of Fincantieri's international shipbuilding projects. Fincantieri have also signed a memorandum of understanding with Hoffman, which could provide work of up to $250 million to Hoffman and their Australian supply chain. These success stories show the great capabilities and international competitiveness of Australia's defence industry. There's always more we can do to support Australian defence companies and to further transition to an export-oriented, advanced manufacturing future. Defence exports are an essential part of our vision for Australia's defence industry. Exports will sustain industry through peaks and troughs in domestic demand. They'll hone our international competitiveness and promote international engagement. Ahead of the release of the Defence Export Strategy in early 2018, as Minister for Defence Industry, I've been building up some important international relationships and partnerships that we need to support our interests and to pave the way for greater defence exports. Over the past 12 months, I've been to the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, France, Austria, Poland, Saudi Arabia twice, and the UAE twice. On every single one of these official visits, I'm proud to highlight the innovative capabilities of Australian defence industry. We're already widely respected, and there's considerable potential for us to export more of what we do to our friends and our allies. With Poland's Minister for National Defence, I discussed the opportunities for Australian defence companies to export capability, like Thales's Hawkeye. In the UK, our two governments committed to the first ministerial defence industry and capability dialogue. It's since met twice with immediate outcomes. We announced a capability study beginning early next year to assess the potential fitting of Australia's world-leading CEA Technologies CFAR radar on British ships. Our inclusion in the definition of the United States National Industrial and Technology Base, along with the United Kingdom and Canada, is another real opportunity to draw our defence industries closer together and develop areas for further cooperation. This initiative has great potential to decrease the barriers between our four countries. It'll help improve the sustainability of our industrial bases, our ability to develop joint solutions, and enhance our collective warfighting capability. So 2017 has been a busy year of progress and delivery in defence industry. I'm sure 2018 will be even busier. When we look 10 years ahead in this transformation of defence capability, we can see a defence force equipped with far more advanced capabilities than it is today, and with the momentum and the innovation culture needed to continuously augment and improve our capabilities. It will be a transformed strategic industrial base. We don't underestimate the complexity of this. Designing and integrating capabilities, introducing them into service, and deploying them effectively in independent and coalition operations is hard. So we do urge industry to identify its opportunities now and invest in the people, skills, technology, and infrastructure needed for 2, 5, and 10 years from now. Defence, for its part, is upgrading the way it works with industry to position industry to meet our future defence capability needs. I am very proud of what the Turnbull government has done in a very short time, and I have no intention of taking my foot off the accelerator next year. This is the great national enterprise of the next decade. I'm keen for as many Australians to be part of it. The Turnbull government has a clear vision for a globally competitive, sustainable, and sovereign industry. Through it, we can be confident in the renewal of our defence capabilities to safeguard and enrich us in the future. We are serious about having a strong, sovereign, and world-leading defence industry in Australia, because we know that will benefit us all. Clausewitz, in his treatise on war, encouraged analysts to succeed in lending a hand to those who in our dear native land are called upon to speak with authority, that we may excite them to make a candid examination of the subject. I've paraphrased that, but he may well have been writing the Lowy Institute's job description. As you think more about it, you may well wish to ponder how you too might be a bigger part of it. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here.
Thank you, Minister. You've set out your store for defence industry in characteristically confident style. You've kindly agreed to stay and take question and answers. I understand you have to be out of the building promptly for another meeting at 12:25.
So about 20 minutes, which is good.
We'll make sure we don't delay you on that. Just to get the ball rolling, as you mentioned defence exports, I'll take the privilege as moderator to ask the first question. The arms trade is a crowded dog-eat-dog market, and the customer is king. You outlined already a couple of areas where Australia has had some export opportunities, like the Nulka missile decoy system, CFAR radar being another. But in some of our higher tech collaborations with the United States has a proprietary lock on some of that. Mm-hmm. And the United States is also not averse to buying its own equipment. So do you think that, what are the other realistic niches where Australia could find export opportunities in the defence sector?
Well, Ewan, we have to work within the confines of what we can and can't do with the United States. You know, they are the world's modern empire, and they have very clear views about their sovereign capabilities, their defence industry, and how it builds into their dominant position across the world militarily. Still, even with all the hype around the growth of other nations, every second dollar in the world on the military is still spent by the United States. So they are, they have a pretty interest, big interest, proprietorial interest, as you suggest, in defence industry. But this being part of the NTIB, the National Technology and Industrial Base, is quite a breakthrough. And that was achieved because of John McCain, who's a great friend of Australia, of course, including us along with the United Kingdom, in an area that had hitherto only been available to Canada. And what we think it means is that when the United States sees that we have a capability that they would like to use, rather than the old system, which was that the United States would collaborate with that particular company or buy that company or insist that it move to the United States to deliver services or products, they will not do that. They will say that because Australia is part of the NTIB, we're more than happy to treat them as part of our overall economy in defence. Now, that's a really, that could be a very important breakthrough. But there are a lot of other areas where we can sell or export niche products and significant products. Offshore patrol vessels from Austal, remote weapon systems from EOS, targets from Marathon, the Hawkeye and the Bushmaster from Talus. There are capabilities that we wouldn't export because we want to have them here for our submarines, for example, like sonars and so forth, which we have some significant capabilities in. But Aspen Medical, in terms of the setting up of medical services in the battlefield, I mean, there's quite a long list. And you know, what we've discovered in defence industry is that the more you're in it, the more you realise that we have real capabilities that a lot of our defence SMEs have actually been exporting, but they've never had that extra advocacy, that push from government that you see in Italy and France and Germany and Spain and Great Britain and the United States, where their government ministers, members of the royal family even, in spite of being our head of state as well, will go out into markets and compete and push their products and services. So that is a sea change in attitude within the government, that we are going to promote exports of defence where it's appropriate to do so. We are at the beginning of that. We will next year release the Defence Export Strategy. It will be quite a, well, it is a meaty document. It'll have significant spending attached to it and a very different way of doing business.
Thank you. Before I go to the floor, just staying with defence exports, as you mentioned that you had visited Saudi Arabia twice recently, where there is an ongoing conflict resulting now in what is, I think, recognised as a humanitarian catastrophe. What safeguards can you assure us will be in place so that defence exports sold to Saudi Arabia will be used properly and not in, in any way that would tarnish Australia's human rights record?
Well, Ewan, we haven't changed our approach to the defence export permits architecture. There is still the same five or six criteria required for a exporter to gain a defence export permit. That part of the portfolio remains in Maurice Payne's bailiwick, if you like. So obviously we do all the promotion of defence exports in my part of the portfolio. I'm travelling the world trying to drum up business, if you like, to put it crassly, for Australian defence exports. But there'll be no defence exports unless a defence export permit is available for that particular product or service. So if a product or a service has been exported into Saudi Arabia, it has had a defence export permit. Obviously, the war in Yemen is a significant consideration in that. But there are things we can do with the Saudis in the short term and probably more in the longer term, which would gain export permits. And I'm thinking right now of Aspen Medical, which is building a new hospital, the Saad Hospital in northeast Saudi Arabia. I mean, that's obviously a defence export of a kind. And there are other companies that are competing in Saudi where the export wouldn't be used in Yemen but still supports the Saudis in the Red Sea, for example, and ensuring that they are stopping piracy. So and that is very much in our interest as well for offshore patrol vessels and so on.
All right. So I see a couple of questions up already. Could you please identify yourself, your affiliation, keep your question as short, sharp as possible. Gentleman there, and then I'll take Greg Colton from the Institute after that.
Chris Skinner, various things, including Engineers Australia. Minister, you put a lot of emphasis on STEM and attracting people into STEM programs, either for initial education or retraining. On page 2 of the Sydney Morning Herald this morning is a story of a young woman who was forced to go to a boys' high school to study engineering because she wants to do aeronautical engineering and there was no way of doing it through a girls' high school. How will defence industry reach out to young people, their teachers, and most importantly, their parents, to persuade them of the attractiveness of the careers that you've mapped out?
It's a good question. Fortunately, I'm not responsible for the decisions that state governments make with respect to single-sex schools or streamed schools. New South Wales has its own approach to those things, and that's a matter for the state government. I'm sure they're doing an excellent job being a Liberal and national government. But the question, the more broader question is a really important one. So as Malcolm and I often talk about, there's no point in promoting people into science, technology, engineering and maths unless you have jobs for them to do. So these two things work together. They're two sides of the same coin. The big build-up in our defence industry capability in Australia, which will lead to tens of thousands of jobs, and in the June quarter alone, spending in defence industry jumped by 22%, which was the biggest jump ever. So it's starting to show up in the national accounts as driving the economy. The jobs are going to be there now and into the future, and we need the STEM trained people. Previously, I used to be the Minister for Education, we talked a great deal about STEM, but a lot of young people would say, well, you know, I'd love to do science, technology, engineering and maths, but I also want a job in Australia. Well, now we're giving them the opportunity to have those jobs in Australia. The campaign we're running at the moment called the Workforce Behind the Defence Force is designed to do two things. It's a $20 million campaign. It's designed to encourage young people to think about careers in defence industry and to think about those careers not just as being a high-end, high education, master's degrees and undergraduate degrees that they aren't thinking of doing, but pointing out that 60% of the jobs in defence industry are trades jobs, but they are skilled tradespeople doing specialist work, and they're very important. So the campaign has the first aspect of it is to encourage young people to talk about defence industry in a way they perhaps hadn't considered before, and to convince their parents and their grandparents, who are, in spite of being the father of four teenage children, they do sometimes, you know, take my advice and listen to their parents and more so their grandparents, thinking about their careers. And we want older people, parents and grandparents of the young people, to say, have you thought about a job in the defence industry? You know, you're interested in engineering or interested in science or maths or trades or welding or fitting and turning or electrical. You should do that because you'll get a job in the defence industry. We want people to see defence industry as a career for life, not a career for a project. And in the past, it's been project by project, and we've never been able to get that ballast that keeps the industry going through peaks and troughs and means that people will stay, be able to keep getting jobs in defence industry if they make that career choice now. The second aspect of the campaign is to convince business that if they haven't thought about the defence industry, that they should be thinking about how to get into the defence industry. Not every SME is going to be able to be a supplier to the defence industry, but we want them all to ask the question, do I want to do that? What capabilities do I need to bring into my business?
What infrastructure spending do I need to do? What investments do I need to make? And is that all not the area that I want to be in? Fine, they can make that choice. But we want them to be thinking about being in the defence industry because, my view, that breeds more work, more activity, more seeking work. So when the United States, whether it's a Raytheon or an Airbus from France or whomever it might be, think about the capabilities in Australia, there are defence industry businesses that can provide those capabilities. And they don't think we'll have to bring somebody from France or the US or the UK because those capabilities don't exist here. So that's what we're doing. We're creating the jobs that mean that young people have a purpose for doing STEM, whereas previously they might not have had those opportunities.
Minister, I'm just going to ask you to hold your answer so we can get two questions in together, Greg Colton and then Peter in the front row.
Thanks, Ewan. Greg Colton from the Lowy Institute. Minister, major platform acquisition consumes a large part of the defence budget, but it also takes a significant amount of time from identifying a need through to delivery of a capability. In an era where new disruptive technologies are being unveiled at an unprecedented rate, how do the Department of Defence and defence industry future-proof the development of capabilities so that they are not obsolete prior to or shortly after delivery without causing the large cost and timeline blowouts that we've seen in the past?
Okay, and Peter Scott.
Peter Scott, Defence New South Wales. You mentioned the CRC for Trusted Autonomous Systems, Minister. So firstly, I'm wondering if you can give us an update on when we might expect a decision on where the headquarters for that CRC would be announced. And also, what linkages do you see between the work of the CRCs and the export strategy?
The CRCs or the CRC?
Well, the CRC on the Trusted Autonomous Systems.
That's the only one in defence. At the moment?
At the moment.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like special pleading from New South Wales for the headquarters of the Trusted Autonomous CRC.
We've certainly made a submission, Minister.
So Jim McDowell is the chairman, and I have a call to return to Jim from yesterday, and I think it's about where he wants to put the headquarters. So I'm not interfering in this process. We appointed Jim for a good reason, and he's doing a great job in narrowing the areas for the Trusted Autonomous Systems CRC where they're going to put their focus. It's about $50 million, which sounds like a lot of money, but you can spend $50 million in defence pretty quickly, as you know. So in terms of the headquarters, I guess it'll be pretty soon. Anything to be announced between now and Christmas is a bit lost at the moment. There's so much happening, but I think people probably would quite like to know. And it's so I think it'll be quite soon, as soon as Jim lets me know, as soon as I return that call, which you've reminded me, so I'll do it on my way to the airport this afternoon. The Comcar driver will be the first to know. Comcar drivers know everything, by the way. We want to stay friends with the Comcar drivers at all costs. In terms of the timelines, and look, there is a lot of stress on the Department of Defence because we are doing a great deal quickly. I have to say that Defence has been terrific. Dennis Richardson really faithfully implemented the PIVA review of how we do business in Defence. That's having a really demonstrable effect inside Defence. So while we've dropped about 4,000 public servants in Defence, they're actually bringing out a lot more output. People in Defence are now much more likely to make decisions and take responsibility for those decisions, whereas I think previously the culture was less likely. People at the top had to make decisions, but a lot of people on the way up didn't want to. I think they're now feeling quite empowered. I go down or go up to Russell Hill quite often and go out to some of the other places at Brindabella to thank them for the good work they're doing, whether it's the offshore patrol vessels team for doing everything on schedule in terms of the tenders. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that, you know, if Defence said that they were going to deliver something in a particular month, they meant it could be that month, you know, or it could be another month, you know. But now when they say we're going to deliver something to you in April or June or October, I keep them to that promise. So now they're very careful about what they're promising to do, but they are actually doing it. Now, so far, we're not seeing any slippage in the schedules for these major projects or the minor projects for that matter. which is an achievement of its own. In terms of the future, look, it's not easy to predict. I mean, we have a great team of people within defence. The large primes have their own terrific teams that think about how all these projects, all the timelines, and how they all work together. I can't guarantee that everything will always stay on schedule or on budget, for that matter. But we're certainly doing our darndest to do both. I've got great confidence in Steve Johnson and Greg Sammet and Tony Dalton. We've just changed a bit of the structure around shipbuilding. So previously, we didn't have a shipbuilding enterprise czar, so which of course is not a technical or official term, but Steve Johnson is now the naval shipbuilding enterprise czar. So he's responsible for the whole of the enterprise. And then Tony Dalton is doing ships and Greg Sammet is doing submarines, and that system, that structure is working really well. So I can't give it any guarantees. I'd be foolish if I did, but I can tell you that so far it is going very well. It's on schedule. It's on budget. We did cut steel on the Pacific patrol boats on time. We will cut steel on the offshore patrol vessels on time. We came up with a quite innovative solution, I think, to the offshore patrol vessels. We did the same thing with the naval combat systems. It's the first time we've ever had a Navy-wide enterprise approach to combat systems, which means that Saab, CEA and Lockheed Martin, so Navy got Aegis, which is what they wanted, but Australian industry will have a huge part because of the CEA and Saab and, of course, Lockheed Martin, Australian operations. So we are thinking, I think, cleverly and challenging past methods of doing things. I hope that we'll be able to stay on schedule for everything. But, you know, if I'm still the Minister for Defence Industry in 10 years, that would be quite a surprise. Not because I'm assuming something's going to happen to me, but the cycle of politics is such that very few ministers are ministers for a decade or more. But we are setting up the foundations so that whoever comes in the future in defence industry has a very solid foundation from which to build. And unusually, I'm including Richard Miles in a lot of my briefs and discussions about what we're doing, because while I don't want a Labor government at all at the next election, and I believe that we won't get one, I think we will win again the next election. At some point down the track, he might well be a Minister for Defence or Defence Industry, and I want him to know why we're doing these things, because I don't want all this effort that I see all these people in the room have been putting into defence industry and seeing this new renaissance that we've created. If a government changes in 3 years or 6 years or 9 years or whenever it might be, a new government saying, we're not going to do any of that anymore, we'll have a whole different approach, because then I think a lot of people will say, that was our opportunity to make this a bipartisan area for the economy, for defence capability, and now it's lost.
Well, Minister, I wish we could keep you here a little longer to interrogate you more on your portfolio, but we at the Lowy Institute believe in our part of the bargain in maintaining the schedule.
Well, I was late, so I'm sorry about that. So, are you having a go at me, you?
ladies and gentlemen, please can I just ask you to show your appreciation to the Honourable Christopher Pyne for his excellent presentation today.
Thank you. Thank you, Ewan.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. Thank you.